best college football coverage in Utah is right here on the Zone Sports Network.
Got him!
The Pac-12 championship game is finally here, and the Utes look to earn their first ever Pac-12 title and a trip to the Rose Bowl as they battle Oregon in Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas this Friday. You're listening to Hans Olsen and Scotty G on 97.5 1280 The Zone and the Zone Sports Network.
Hans Olsen, Scott Girard, 97.5, 1280 The Zone, and The Zone Sports Network. Pac-12 championship game coming up on Friday as the University of Utah takes on Oregon. Second time these two teams have played in about 3 weeks, and help break it down on the Smart Rain guest line. Beat reporter for the Ducks, for the Oregonian, James Krepia, kind enough to join us. James, how are you?
Hey, James.
Doing well. How you guys doing?
Very good.
Very good, thank you. What are your thoughts on how Oregon avoids a repeat of what we saw a couple weeks ago?
Well, there were things in what was a dominant performance by Utah, to be clear. Let's start with that, because I'm certainly not an apologist, nor am I a fan. So let's lay the groundwork for, you know, the preface of the conversation. That was a dominant performance by Utah, absolutely dominant performance 11 days ago. So that's the part that anybody objectively assessing this going into Friday night's game has to start with. How will that change? Now, how do you close a 31-point gap when that was part of it? Well, there were things along the way in that that were somewhat circumstantial. If Oregon is going to try and close a gap that enormous and not be quite as dominated, surely, how do you do that? Well, it wasn't as though their running game that night, while in gross number, certainly was not good. Now, 63 rushing yards ain't going to get it done. But it was not as though early that their two primary backs weren't having any success. It's just that when the score got completely away from them, it became impossible. And obviously Utah got a couple of sacks in there. That skewed some numbers as well. But they were not able to establish the ground game as well. And a lot of that had to do with circumstance. You know, you run a play, you gain a yard on first down, it's second and nine. Now all of a sudden there's a false start, and now you're at second and 14. Well, you're not going to run the football. So that's not what this, you know, that happened, you know, once or twice in the first half. And obviously the final 3 minutes of the first half completely changes it, completely flips it, where it goes from 14-0 to 28-0 in 3 minutes. Well, then you're not running the football at all. It's just basically impossible. So there were things along the way there that if they're going to try and close a gap that was that enormous 11 days ago, you have to be able to better establish the run early, not have those self-inflicted mistakes like false starts in particular, which this team is really, you know, historically speaking and characteristically, they don't commit a lot of pre-snap penalties. It happened, okay, you're on a road setting, it does happen, but they really put themselves behind it a couple times. And yeah, look, Utah's defense is still going to create some havoc. So you can't say, well, don't allow any sacks. Well, that sounds novel, but grand scheme of things, you know, sometimes, you know, the other defense is trying too. So I think that they have to really avoid a lot of the self-inflicted errors that they put themselves in and committed, for one. Two, defensively, that was the worst tackling game that Oregon's defense had, not just this season. I'm not even sure last season, in the messy season it was, that they had a worse performance. That was awful. And there are plenty of players on the defense who tell you that it was awful. I mean, you have Verone McKinley III is a Thorpe finalist, missing a tackle in the open field, which it's difficult, but, I mean, he just gets embarrassed on that play. And he was as forthright as it got when it came to – he called it embarrassing again this week. It was a total collective effort. And obviously the play to Keithy that flips everything there, and it leads to the third touchdown. And then you add special teams. It was a wall-to-wall, pillar-to-post dominant performance by Utah. How do you flip it? Well, lots of things. You tackle better. You don't commit self-inflicted errors. And then you don't punt to you know, Covey, maybe ever. I think at that point you're better off just, you know, punting into the 15th row would be better than punting to Brayden Covey, I would say.
So that's where I was going to start.
I was curious about Oregon's special teams performances throughout the year because they gave up a blocked field goal. They gave up a punt return for a touchdown. Utah has suffered so many self-inflicted harmful moments in their special teams. And against Oregon, they rose to this massive occasion and had a great special teams performance. Has Oregon been down in the special teams department throughout the year?
It's been kind of a mixed bag. It really has. And it's been more than this season. And frankly, it even goes back to last season. Really, it's depending on which unit we're referring to. Some of it even spilled back to 2019. There are areas of special teams. And the problem with special teams as a whole, in college football anywhere, whether we're talking about Oregon and Utah this weekend and Friday and Pac-12 championship game, or really any team in the country, is that when you look at it statistically, one play in special teams can skew numbers dramatically. And may not be complete. It can skew an average dramatically because how many punt returns does a team really allow in a season? You know, Oregon at home has barely allowed any when they've played at home. It just hasn't happened. So, which is what made the return by Covey that much more like a what happened, because they really don't allow very many punt returns. Now, yeah, we could factor in between altitude, ball placement, and general poor strategy that led to the punt in the first place. Well, there you have it. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not just the averages. It's how they have covered both punts and kickoffs in coverage for the past two seasons has been far more in the poor category than the positive category. Their kicker, who has had obviously you guys probably know, like, leading into that game, he had not missed a kick. And then obviously he had the block and the miss. Not a phenomenal kicker by any stretch. He lost the job last season, came back in the offseason, credit to him, stuck with it, earned the job back. And like I say, started off the season nicely. The block had nothing to do with him. The block had to do with the right side of the protection that just completely missed on a block there. But the miss, how much did the block play into it in his own mind, or how much did he just plain miss, I can't speak to. But ultimately, you can't really predict if a kicker is going to miss a kick, to say the least. That's not their issue, though. And on kickoffs, he's had good moments, and he's had tougher ones by way of either ball placement. He's had a few that go out of bounds, one that happened this past weekend, actually, that went out of bounds, where he had been better at it, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, after he has four, five, six, whatever, eight straight kickoffs, and you're like, oh, okay, you know, there's a bunch of touchbacks in there. All of a sudden, you know, one of them sails out of bounds again. You know, on a proportion standpoint, not great. They've had issues there, but particularly in coverage. And then this past weekend, they got caught napping on an onside kick by Oregon State. That's just inexcusable. Absolutely inexcusable. Given the circumstance of the game in the fourth quarter and what was going on, it was kind of obvious that Oregon State might think of something like that just because it didn't line up in a bunch formation. Didn't mean anything. And it had happened to Oregon a couple times late last season. So, like I say, it was clearly something that has been an issue for them now for, like I say, the better part of the last two seasons in various areas of special teams, whether talking about kickoff return. Yeah, the return guys may be pretty good, but there are areas that are a problem for Oregon on special teams, particularly, like I say, either especially kickoff and punt return coverage. If they're not getting either a fair catch on a punt or a touchback or fair catch on a kickoff, that's a concern. It is.
There's often times where you get a rematch throughout a season where a team is genuinely fired up to play that team again. They, you know, let's say, you know, like that, the Oregon game, Utah-Oregon game, where Utah put it on them pretty good, and where Oregon's like, yeah, let's go. We want a rematch. We want to play this team, and we want to prove that was kind of a anomaly. Then there's sometimes where deep down in the locker room, they're like, I don't know, man. We really don't want to see that team again. You know, that was not pretty. I got to imagine Oregon is leaning towards the first option there, but do you feel a lot of confidence from this team going into this game?
Yeah, from the guys who we spoke to, I mean, they are, look, any competitor, but especially a Mario Cristobal program and the way they're all wired, the way they play, and obviously what they were competing for a large swath of the season, and certainly heading into the game 11 days ago. To be embarrassed on that scale, and that just doesn't happen. You know, that didn't happen at all in the Cristobal era. Go back to 2018, and that was, you know, more of a still kind of building and foundational sort of year. And there was nothing like that. So So, no, these guys still got a lot of pride here. And, no, nobody felt real good about that outcome for sure. You know, make that abundantly clear. That was just plain ugly in every way imaginable. When you get to the rematch aspect of it, though, yeah, I know the adage is that, you know, it's hard to beat a team twice and all that kind of stuff. Well, not historically in the Pac-12 championship game. That hasn't really been something that's held true in Pac-12 championship games. Rematches have basically gone uniformly to the regular season winner. Now, there is a slight difference insofar as there have not been that many meetings where the conference championship game occurred so close. There was only one of those where the rematch occurred within the same kind of time span that we're looking at here. And I want to say it was Stanford. I want to say it was Stanford UCLA, but it was one of them a couple of years ago where they actually played back-to-back weeks. And yes, it was Stanford UCLA, and Stanford still won both of them back in 2012. Otherwise, most of the rematches that have occurred, I want to say it's either five or six, all but one of them was a sweep. And the only team in Pac-12 history in the era in the last decade where there's been a conference championship game who evened things up in the conference title game was Oregon in 2014 against Arizona. You know, they lost early in the season, and then they came back and avenged that loss later on. That's it. Otherwise, in Pac-12 championship game history, the regular season winner goes on and wins. Do I think that is that any indication of necessarily what occurs on Friday night? No, it's just, you know, something of note when people, you know, resort to that adage, like I say, of, oh, it's hard to beat a team twice. Well, like I say, historically speaking, that's just not true in the Pac-12. I can't speak to all SEC history or Big 12 history or what have you, but in the Pac-12, that has not been the case.
James, after that loss for Oregon, how did you feel they responded against Oregon State?
I think that they stuck to the things what we were talking about before about establishing the run and those things. They did that offensively in a big way. Oregon established its identity and stayed true to its identity against Oregon State. And Oregon State did not. And not only when Oregon basically forced them to not stick to their identity because they had and built such a, you know, significant lead, just as Utah did against Oregon at 28-0. At 31-9, yeah, Oregon State doesn't have the luxury of sitting there running the ball methodically. Similar situation. No, Oregon State, for reasons that I'll never understand, and now that we're at the end of the season and recruiting's going on and those things, and I don't cover Oregon State, I'm not sure I'll have the luxury of ever hearing from Jonathan Smith or anybody at OSU as to why they did what they did. But really, schematically speaking, they do some things similar to Utah, and they voluntarily chose to go away from them. Now, that's for Oregon State to answer for. I have no idea why they did that. But they have a ton of success. They have one of the best ground games in the league, if not the country, and they do it by paving the road with two tight ends. They open the game with the two tight ends, pick up 4 yards, pick up 6 yards, move the sticks, and then just choose to make a substitution and not go with two tight ends for the rest of the drive. Oregon builds a 14-0 lead, and off to the races they go. Well, like I say, at 24-3 or 31-9, thanks for taking your tight ends off the field. I joked going into the game that if I were Oregon State, I wouldn't line a wide receiver on the field after what Utah did with its tight ends to Oregon. And many teams had done it to the Ducks all season.
Yeah.
Again, that's for Oregon State to answer for. What did Oregon do? They stayed true on possession and 10 in the first half, all four of them run plays. 18 first downs in the first half, 13 of them run plays. That's this Oregon offense. They stayed true to themselves. And they did a better job against the run as a whole. Like I say, the multi-tight end thing is still a bit of a concern for this defense, but that's been a concern all season, and that's an area that I still think, obviously, Utah has a very big schematic advantage because of what we saw not only 11 days ago, but it's been a season-long issue for this Oregon defense.
Line in this game is Utah 2.5-point favorite, which means essentially it's anybody's game in terms of a Vegas belief. Your thought is to what we're going to expect. Obviously, nobody's expecting another blowout. Do you anticipate drama in the fourth quarter in this game?
I think it could be. Yeah, I do. I've said so far this week, like, the thing I can't get past is that Utah dominated the line of scrimmage on both sides. And when they have a schematic, what they do offensively is so advantageous, not just in general, but particularly against an Oregon defense that has struggled with it, with, like I say, with the multi-tight end deal. Those are things that I can't get past the hurdle of saying Utah has and is still the favored team and should be the favored team, and with a 31-point win, should be the favored team going into the game. However, like I say, are there some areas where Oregon can certainly, in a rematch setting, avoid certain issues? Sure, sure. I do think it'll be much more competitive than the first time. I think it very well could be a one-score game by the end of it. Early in the week, I'd had it at 31-21 Utes. I probably will end up picking it a little bit closer, whether it be a touchdown or a field goal. And I don't like going up against it when I know what the line is, saying like, oh, it's 3 points and looks like I'm tiptoeing around it. But I'm really not. I think it'll be a more competitive. But Utah was. They were so sound at the line of scrimmage both ways. I don't know how any objective observer of the first game can say, oh, well, Oregon will obviously just turn that completely around the next time around. Well, in certain aspects, it can't get any worse, quite honestly. And that's just, you just got to be real about it. I mean, what Utah did was so sound and was so strong at the line of scrimmage. And offensively, what the Utes did was hardly complicated. Like I say, they stayed true to themselves. It was almost embarrassing for Oregon's defense in that, beyond the tackling, which is bad and all that, I'm talking about more of, this wasn't complicated. You just ran the ball away from Kayvon Thibodeau. That's you know, next level football here. I mean, that's, you could ask a junior high coach, what are you going to do with the best player in America? Go away from him. All right, well, sounds pretty good. Yeah, Oregon has got to make adjustments to things like that far better, and they had at other times in the season. They just got so manhandled at the line of scrimmage in that game that, like I say, I still give the advantage to the Utes soundly, but I do think it's going to be a lot more competitive than the first game that we saw.
So, James, I wanted to throw a question at you about Lincoln Riley, since you cover the Pac-12 so closely. Do you think Lincoln Riley will have USC up and clicking as one of the top, back where they were years ago, as one of the top contenders in the South?
I mean, in full disclosure, heading into the season, I was the one foolish enough to, among the many in the Pac-12 preseason media poll, to think that the talent at SC would be able to overcome and actually win a division. For, you know, silly me. I'll be the first to disclose where I stood many months ago on that. He's still inheriting some talent. Obviously, I've seen, you know, as everybody has, you know, some initial flips and things like that in the recruiting realm. That said, are they going to get better? And I think they could go from being a 5-win team this year and have real improvement, real significant improvement next season. Do I think they're going to win the division next season? I can't possibly make that kind of call on December 1st. I need to see, you know, there's so much that could happen between transfer portal and recruiting and everything else. But ultimately, he can still only bring in up to 32 guys this offseason. And yeah, it's a lot. But they're not all going to be transfers. They're not, you know, he's not bringing in the entire Oklahoma roster to help him out. Which, even if he did, by the way, I'm not sure that solves all the problems. But the bottom line is, are they going to be more competitive? Yeah. Having said that, are there some issues that USC has had under Clay Helton? Which, by the way, I know that, like, there's a lot of revisionist history when it comes to, like, everyone thinks that Helton was just horrific. I don't know. He won a division last year, and many people would have told you that the championship game shouldn't have happened once Washington had to pull out, and did win a Rose. I mean, you know, it wasn't like it was an abject disaster. There were plenty of areas that were not good, admittedly, offensive line play among them. But one area that still holds true between Lincoln Riley and the Helton era at USC was a lot of self-inflicted errors, a lot of penalties. No, Oklahoma wasn't in the bottom five every year in penalties. But there were some years there in these last 4 or 5 years where Oklahoma was right there with USC in penalties. So this whole idea that, like, he's coming in, there's going to be this culture of accountability and all that, I'm not saying it's not going to be improved because there basically was none previously. But this idea that, like, the new sheriff in town is, like, this iron-fisted guy, it's like, I don't know. No? I mean, what? You know, are they going to be better? Yeah, of course. I think they're going to be better. I think he's one of the great offensive minds in the sport right now. It's terrific. He's an outstanding offensive coach. But he also played in a league where I believe the Big 12 had 12 defensive players drafted, I want to say. It was either last year or the year before. I mean, the Pac-12 isn't lighting it up by way in that aspect, but it's better than that. Mm. You know, so, yeah, are they going to put up some offensive numbers? I have no doubt they're going to put up all kinds of crazy offensive numbers. I didn't think offensive production at times, you know, I don't know. I know he's been hurt for the last month or so, but I remember that Drake London's still on this team. I remember that this is still an air raid that was putting up all kinds of passing numbers. I don't think they're going to do that anymore. They're going to, you know, by way of air raid, they'll run the ball and establish that a bit better for sure. But this notion that, like, what, SC was like 12th in everything and just like a complete dumpster fire in every way imaginable? No, they've got a lot of talent. They have the best, and when he was healthy, the best receiver in the country by a country mile. And there's some other terrific receivers, obviously. I think there's narrative construction going on out there by way of what he is inheriting and what he's bringing that is just not completely in alignment with reality. Having said that, I still think he's an excellent coach and that SC is going to be better, a lot better. Do I know if they're going to win the South next year? No, I can't make that call here on December 1st. I think they'll be a lot better. Do I think that they could be a repeated division winner for years to come, give it 2 years, 3 years, etc.? Sure, absolutely. But, you know, the proof is going to be in the pudding. It doesn't happen overnight.
James, great insight, man. We appreciate it. Thanks for joining us, and look forward to catching some of you down the line. Enjoy the game coming up this weekend.
Thanks, guys.
James Crepia from the Oregonian, as well as Fox Sports Eugene, right here on the Zone Sports Network.